Let me take the opportunity to thank David and the Institute for Theoretical Physics, and Joel and the individuals at the Cancer Center of Santa Barbara for such wonderful hospitality for during this week. We have a series of scientists coming in from all over the country, indeed all over the world, who are going to address lots of questions at the interface of physics and computational biology and mathematics and biology, and really beginning to move into a whole new field, a whole new direction for biology. But tonight I want to actually celebrate with you a little bit the last 40 or so years in biology, because we are in the midst of a remarkable revolution in my science, in the science of biology, that probably begins in the year 1953 with the structure of DNA, the genetic information being worked out by Francis Crick and James Watson. And from those beginnings, the field of molecular biology, that's the study of life at the level of molecules, began. And with that study, our understanding at a very deep level of what life and life processes really are. And it's been that revolution that begins to pay off today, and it's that revolution I want to tell you a little bit about the history of, focusing on a specific area of the revolution, focusing on how molecular biology has made its impact upon cancer research, upon our understanding of a disease, you'll see, that we didn't even know what questions to ask about this disease, cancer, as recently as the 19th decade of the 1960s. So I'm going to begin by telling you a little bit of a history. It'll be a personal history, I have to admit, because I became a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia in the year 1961. So that's actually only about 8 years after Watson and Crick elucidated the structure of DNA. And at the time, I knew two things about where my career should go. At least I thought I knew two things. One is I was very interested in working with viruses. And the reason is viruses are extremely simple. In fact, the virus I've settled on working on had only six genetic elements, six genes. And that means it had six functions. And it is a virus. It's an obligate parasite. It replicates, in this case, this virus replicated in monkeys. And it took advantage of all of the functions that the cells had that it replicated in. So to duplicate itself, it's a parasite, if you will, uses the cell, often kills the cell. But I was interested in viruses that actually cause cancer because of how simple these viruses could be and yet how complex a disease these viruses could cause. And in 1961, as I was a first-year graduate student, as I recall it, we actually knew four things about cancer. We knew four simple facts about cancer. And I want to start by sharing with you, by taking you back to the laboratory, if you will, before I became a respected theorist now, taking you back to the laboratory and telling you a little bit about the four things that we knew about cancer at the time. They're listed here. The first thing we knew about cancer was that cancer could be caused by some viruses. And the history of this really dates back all the way to 1911, when a gentleman named Peyton Rouse was working at the Rockefeller Medical Research Institute in New York. And Peyton Rouse decided, much like I did when I was a first-year graduate student, to work on cancer in 1911. And he was very fortunate in that a chicken farmer from New Jersey came across the Hudson River over to the east side where Rockefeller Medical Research Institute was, and he presented Rouse with a chicken that had a tumor of the breast. And in this case, it was a tumor of the muscle tissue of the chicken breast, and therefore the tumor was called the sarcoma. And he said to Peyton Rouse at the time, he said, "You've got to find out what causes this tumor in this chicken, because all the chickens in the flock get cancer when I have this chicken in my coop." All right. And Peyton Rouse thought about that for a little while, and he realized that that was a bit heretical. Was it possible that cancer could be an infectious disease? And so he took the tumor and he tested it for a virus. And he did it by the techniques of the day, 1911. He would take the tumor and grind it up so there are no cells at all left in the tumor. And he'd take the supernatant of the tumor, the juice that came from the cells, and he'd filter it through a filter that was so fine that it restricted all possible cells and all possible bacteria, which you could see under a microscope were about 1 micron in size. And then what caused the cancer went through the filter. And he could prove that by taking the solution that went through the filter. He inoculated another chicken, and the chicken got a tumor. And that was, in fact, the definition of the viruses of the day. It was a filterable agent. You couldn't see it under the light microscope. It was so small. It took 40 years to invent the electron microscope to see the virus. But nonetheless, he believed it was an agent, even though he couldn't see it, because it was a filterable agent. It wasn't a bacteria. And he published a paper in 1911 saying that viruses could cause cancer. And he had one example. And that actually came to be called the Rous sarcoma virus. And I'll come back to that virus. A very important role in our history lesson later on. And so in the year 1911, we had a good fact under our belt. We knew viruses could cause cancer. And it wasn't many years later, about 1918, and the story now moves to Tokyo in Japan, where Yamagawa and Ichikawa discovered that if they took some chemicals, it had to be certain chemicals, chemicals they could find in coal tars and chemicals they could find in cigarette smoke. And they took these chemicals and they painted the chemicals on the backs of mice or other animals. And sure enough, at the site where they painted the chemicals, a skin cancer arose. And they reproducibly could demonstrate that purified chemicals, later called carcinogens, could in fact cause cancer. And so by 1918, we knew two facts, two hard-won facts. We knew that viruses could cause cancer and chemicals could cause cancer. Now, that started two whole new fields, one called viral carcinogenesis, one called chemical carcinogenesis. And in 1961, I joined the viral carcinogenesis field. I wanted to study viruses. But we never spoke to the people who were for chemical carcinogenesis. In fact, we thought they were wrong, and they thought we were wrong. And we never even went to the same meetings. Right? And what viruses and chemicals had in common, we didn't even bother to think about very often. And yet, any good theory or hypothesis had to unite these facts in some way. Well, it was in between the 1930s and 50s, starting in the Jackson Laboratory in Maine. Now we moved back to the United States in Maine. A laboratory is started for the breeding and production of mice for research. And this laboratory realized very early on that it would be very useful to have strains of mice that were genetically identical. And if they were genetically identical, that would take one of the variables that we have in the human population, we're all genetically different, one of the variables and eliminate it, because that strain had every gene in the body of the mouse the same. And actually, you accomplish this with mice by something you can't even do with humans or other species. You do matings of brothers and sisters, so you inbreed them, for about 9 or 10 generations. And then the mouse approaches, asymptotically, approaches about a 99% identity. And every mouse, there are white mice, there are black mice, there are brown mice with spots. Every mouse is genetically identical, and some of those mice develop cancer. And they develop cancer because of the genes they have. Right? And so for the first time in the 30s and 40s, as mice, it became apparent in mice that strains of mice that were genetically identical reproducibly developed cancer. And we, for the first time, appreciated genes could cause cancer. And in fact, once that was appreciated, in the literature began to appear that cancer could run in families and human beings. That there are some families that have high incidence of cancer and other families that have low incidence. And at that time, the 30s through the 50s, it was not at all apparent how to isolate such a gene and how to identify it, but we became confident at that point in the 30s to the 50s that viruses could cause cancer, chemicals could cause cancer, and genes could cause cancer. But what viruses and chemicals and genes had to do with each other, and what was the relationship between them, was something we didn't know how to think about. And then by the 1950s, the fourth fact that I knew as a graduate student became apparent. Right after the war, 1945, the federal government began the process of building the National Institutes of Health. And they created institutes for different diseases and health, and they created a National Cancer Institute. And the job of the National Cancer Institute was to find out what caused cancer. And they hired scientists called epidemiologists who asked the question, what are the variables as we go through life? Our environment, our jobs, our exposure to chemicals, the sex we have, our ethnic backgrounds. What are the variables of the environment and our genes that predispose us to cancer? And one of the remarkable things Armitage and Dahl found in 1954 was truly, I'll show you the graph that came from the Armitage and Dahl result, was that there was almost a thousandfold increase in the frequency of cancer as a function of our age. That at the age of about 55 to 60, the frequency at which we get cancer, the incidence, the number of cancers per individuals in the group at 60, 61, 62, starts to increase exponentially and goes up a thousandfold. So we can say aging causes cancer. Right? And now we had the four facts that I knew as a student. Viruses cause cancer, chemicals cause cancer, genes cause cancer, and aging causes cancer. All of these things are true. But to a 23-year-old, 22-year-old graduate student and everybody else around me, we were really perplexed at how we put these things together. How do we make a unified hypothesis that ties all of these things together in some way? Right? And that was the challenge through the 1960s. And the challenge began to be met in a remarkable set of experiments carried out not far north of here at the University of California, San Francisco Medical School by two young scientists, Mike Bishop and Harold Varmus, who were studying Rous sarcoma virus. They were studying the very virus that Rous discovered in 1911. And what they found out was that Rous sarcoma virus comes to us actually in two flavors. There's one of those viruses that doesn't cause tumors in chickens. When you inoculate it into chickens, the virus doesn't cause a tumor. And they went in and they had the technology in the 1970s to literally count the genes that that virus had, the functional units that made the virus. And they found there were three genes that Rous sarcoma virus had when it didn't cause cancer. And then they had another strain of Rous sarcoma virus that did cause cancer. When inoculated into chickens, it caused the cancer. And furthermore, that virus that causes sarcomas, tumors of the muscle cells of the breast, that virus had four genes, not three genes. And so they made the very reasonable hypothesis that the extra gene that the virus had was causing the cancer. And then at the University of California in Berkeley, a fellow named Steve Martin managed to take a virus with four genes and make a mutation in it to convert it to a virus with three genes, and it stopped causing cancer. And that became stronger and stronger evidence that this fourth gene causes the cancer in chickens. And they termed that gene SOC, or an oncogene. Onco, cancer, gene, gene. So onco from the Greek, cancer-causing gene, and they termed that an oncogene. And actually, from the year 1976 on through the 1980s and 1990s even, we isolated a large number of viruses that contained oncogenes, and in fact, those viruses cause cancer in various kinds of animals. In fact, today, just to fill you right up to the moment with what we know, there are six different viruses in the human population that cause various kinds of cancer. Two of which are very common and cause liver cancer. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C are very, very common viruses and are a major cause of liver cancer in Asia especially, but also the United States. Chronic infections with these viruses. So it's really clear that that path led to a productive direction, but the work of Varmus and Bishop to identify a gene in a virus that causes cancer, you will see immediately united viruses with genes. Because it is, in fact, the ability of a virus to pick up a gene that, in fact, caused the cancer. Now, where did that gene come from? Where did it find the extra gene that caused the cancer? And that was the second experiment that led to really the Nobel Prize, in fact, for Mike Bishop and Harold Varmus. In the second experiment, they asked, where is this gene in the virus coming from? And they found that the original gene, something that looked a lot like the gene in a virus, was found in the normal chromosomes of chickens. In other words, the virus picked up the gene from the chromosome of chickens, inserted it into a virus, changed it in some way, and that made the cancer. Right. So the seeds of these genes are in ourselves. In fact, they showed that we have a gene called SOC, right? Same as, just like the chicken has that gene, humans have that gene. Right? It's not actually picked up by viruses in humans, but we have the seeds of causing cancer in our genes. Right? Again, uniting genes with viruses. And when they looked at carefully at the information in that gene, in the parlance of the biologists, when they sequenced the information in that gene, they found that the gene in the virus had a couple of mutations or changes that occurred in the information, and that's what caused the cancer. The gene in us is latent. It doesn't cause cancer. It's normal, and it has a normal function for us. But when it suffers a mutation, when it's picked up by the virus and suffers a mutation, changes, it becomes an oncogene that causes cancer. And what causes that mutation are a series of chemicals in the environment called carcinogens or mutagens. And that experiment united three of these viruses, chemicals, and genes. And suddenly by the 1970s, we had what we thought was our full understanding of cancer in humans. We have a series of genes. We're exposed to environmental carcinogens and mutagens. They damage our genetic information, our DNA. They make mutations in the DNA. And then those genes change, and they become oncogenes, which cause cancer. And by 1980, we were pretty satisfied with that explanation. Very happy, in fact. And had, like all scientists, the propensity to forget about the fact that nothing I've told you explains why aging should in fact be an important element in cancer, a thousandfold increase in the rate. Right? And so aging really was a problem for us. Now let me show you a little bit. I brought along some of the information about aging so you'll see how dramatic it is. This is the age of the cohorts in the population, and this is the percentage of individuals who will develop cancer at those different ages. And what you could, actually if I extrapolated it back all the way to zero, what you can see is the rate is extremely low. The chance of getting cancer at the age of 40 is very, very low. This shows a sexual dimorphism, something that will come up later on, that males and females are really different in biological terms. And in fact, females will develop cancer at a later age. And the men develop cancer, but look at how sharply this curve goes up. And it goes up from a very low number, almost a thousandfold in rate with age. And then actually, most interesting, the curve, this is the original data from Armitage and Dahl, but as we now know, it starts to the rate actually starts to slow down and level off above 80 to 85. There is a slope change here and levels off, as if there's a population where the rate goes up and then once exhausted, there's still a rest of the population that no matter how old you are, you're not going to get cancer at a high rate anymore. The rate starts to slow, right? An interesting observation that we're beginning to understand genetically today. Now, there is a kind of remarkable fact about time. I love the next slide I'm going to show you, because in a physics institute, we learned that time was a relative thing, right? That time could slow, for example, under certain conditions when you go very fast. And that's true of biological time as well. So I'm going to show you a slide which actually demonstrates that. Here I'm just comparing males, right? But I'm comparing humans from the USA or Japan, and I'm comparing dogs, right? And look at this, the curve, three curves are exactly the same for the percent of cancerous age, but I am doing something with dogs. I'm multiplying their age by about 10, right? The dogs, actually dogs are a little bit unusual in the biological world. Many of you know that large dogs have a lifespan of about 8 to 10 years, and small dogs have lifespan about 14 to 16 years. I'm taking the average of that and only working with small dogs, or larger dogs rather. And so I'm only working with a certain inbred strain of dogs, so it's even better than. But nonetheless, watch what's happening here. In relativistic terms, as a percentage of lifespan, right? Not in absolute time, but in a percentage of lifespan, the curves overlap. Everybody increases their rate in the last quarter of their life, no matter whether you live 10 years, if you're a dog, or whether you live 75 years, if you're a human, right? On the average. Right? So there's this unusual relative, and this is true of mice who live 2 years, and it's studied very well in dogs and mice. And now on very thin ice when I tell you it's true for Galapagos turtles who live 170 years. That hasn't been studied in great detail. The tumors of Galapagos turtles are not well characterized, but they don't get tumors until quite late in their life, right? So over a span of 2 years to 170 years as lifespan, you still wait the last quarter of your lifespan. This age phenomenon is a complex thing. And we began to understand that there weren't only oncogenes, that oncogenes could help to cause cancer, but there were, and they caused cancer when they got a mutation. But we had a set of genes in us which helped prevent us from getting cancer, which really helps us all the time through our lives to stop cancer. And because of that, these genes came to be called not oncogenes, cancer-causing genes, but tumor suppressor genes, a second set of genes which in fact prevent cancer, right? And these tumor suppressor genes are kind of interesting. So let me just, I'll give you an example. It sounds abstract, but I'm going to make it concrete for you. Not tonight, but tomorrow morning, here in Santa Barbara, it's sunny every day, I notice, right? So I can, with great authority, predict tomorrow morning when you get up and go out in the sun. Some of you will go out on the golf course and play 18 holes, and you'll wear a short sleeve shirt, and you will not wear a hat, right? And the sun will beat down upon you, and that sun carries energy, ultraviolet radiation. And that energy can react with the cells of your skin. And what it reacts with is the genetic information in your skin, the DNA, and it changes it and it causes mutations, right? And those mutations can accumulate with time, and they would cause skin cancer. That's why everybody tells you to wear number 8 blocker or number 62 blocker, whatever it is. And then everyone tells you to wear a hat and so forth. And it gets very dangerous at places like Australia, where there's a hole in the ozone layer, and where melanomas, the worst of the skin cancers, frequency is going way up because of sun. Right? Sun is a mutagen, a carcinogen for your skin, right? And the tumor suppressor genes protect you against that. And the way they do it is when they recognize that you get a mutation in your skin, they kill the cell that has the mutation, right? This is a programmed cell death. Now that's not a bad thing. Actually, if you got a really bad sunburn, what would happen is your skin would peel. That's programmed cell death at a whole level, right? You're losing half your skin with sunburn, right? Because it's being killed actively by a tumor suppressor gene and its protein. Right? It's protecting you from these mutations. Right? Now, what would happen if you lost your tumor suppressor gene? Right? You wouldn't be protected from those mutations. And if you lost your tumor suppressor gene, you'd have a higher incidence of cancer. But I'm going to show you that's exactly what happens with time. So you have two sets of genes, those that cause cancer when you have mutations, and those that when you lose them because of mutations, you've lost your protection. Probably the best analogy I know is that the oncogenes are the accelerator on a car, the tumor suppressor genes are the brakes. Right? They really stop it. And if you lose your brakes and you lose and you have accelerator smashed to the floor, you got a problem, right? And that's what explains this curve. Within the first 10 or 15 years, you will suffer the first mutation in a cell of your body that might activate an oncogene or inactivate a tumor suppressor gene. And the next 10 or 15 years, you get a second mutation. And then you get a third mutation and a fourth mutation at the age of 50. And four mutations in these oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes still don't give rise to cancer. But now when you get the fifth mutation, the incidence of cancer goes up. So it takes four or five independent mutations in oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes in the same cell of your body. You're really buffered, right? It has to be the same cell of your body, and that cell develops into cancer. And so that's why the time lag, right? Because any one mutation isn't enough. And the dog requires fewer mutations. The dog has slightly fewer tumor suppressor genes than you have, and that's why it looks like relativistic time has collapsed. He has fewer mutations to cause the cancer, right? You're buffered very well. You have a long lifespan by having tumor suppressor genes protect you. And in fact, the gene you heard about that was discovered by my laboratory at Princeton University in 1979 is called P53. That's just the name of the gene. Has no meaning other than that we didn't know what its function was at the beginning. Right? P53 is a tumor suppressor gene that protects you against that sunlight that I've told you about. It also protects you against the food you eat and the air that you breathe, right? Because they're all containing mutagens and carcinogens, and it's just constantly in every cell in your body surveilling and helping you along. And you'll see what happens to individuals. In fact, I'll show you what happens to individuals that don't have that gene, right? So this is the genetics, right? This is a family, right? Males are square, females are round. Anybody who's shaded in has developed cancer. And this is three generations of a family. And the grandfather had a cancer. And then three of the offspring had cancers. In fact, the two males in this case, they married and had children, and they had cancers. There's a female child here that had cancers. And so look at the incidence of cancer in this family. It's behaving as if it's a dominant gene, and that's because they have inherited now, not acquired through the son, but they've inherited a defect in the P53 gene, and that's the family incidence of cancer. Right? We begin to now identify 20, 30, 40 genes that predispose people to cancer if you happen to be born with a mutation in that gene. Now, mutation literally inactivates the function. So you don't have your protective function, right? P53 protects you against stresses of all kinds, the mutagens and carcinogens that come at you throughout life. It protects you by killing the cells that have those mutations, right? And here they lack that, and the inheritance is seen in that fashion, right? Okay, so we caught up very quickly, I think, to the 1990s. And in 1990, we thought we knew the answer to cancer then. We had tumor suppressor genes, we had oncogenes, we could explain all of these things that I've told you about. When we hit the year 2000, a remarkable thing happened in biology that most of you have heard about, actually. It was President Clinton who announced the sequencing of the human genome at the White House, right? That what that meant was, as I said, in the parlance of biology, that we had sequenced all of the genetic information in a human being, in fact, in about 40 human beings in combination, we had sequenced all of the genetic information, and we had a complete list of all the genes of the human, right? A kind of parts manual. It's as if you went to Seattle, and you visited the Boeing plant, and they gave you a book of the parts of building a 747 airplane, right? And you thumb through it and you see each of the parts, and you'd have a complete parts manual. Well, that's what we had. We had got a book, right, of 3 billion bits of information, right? And that 3 billion bits of information, your genetic endowment, right? We had a parts manual. But just as you couldn't have built the 747 from its parts manual, we could hardly build a human being from its parts manual. We have a lot of work to be done. So let me tell you a little bit about how this kind of information, the human genome sequence, and our individuality as human beings, right? Let me tell you a little bit about how that helps explain who gets cancer at what age and who gets cancer at a higher frequency. What's in our genes that's not a mutation, but just the difference between you and I. I told you I'd pick on you tonight. So let's start with a few basic definitions. The genetic information, DNA, comes in chromosomes, and they are paired. So we have two chromosomes. Actually, we have 23 chromosome pairs, or 46, right? So if we just looked in any one of your cells, every one of your cells has 46 chromosomes, and they come in duplicate. And that's going to be important. You have to remember, all information is duplicated. Right? That has real value, as you'll see in a little while. The information is encoded in a chemical code, in letters called nucleotides or bases. And the chemical code we give four letters named CGAT, right? And let me just say that information can be encoded in such a simple alphabet, A, G, C, T, just by working through combinations of it. So A, T, G means something. It has some information in it, right? Just this dot, 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 dash means the letter V. In the Morse code, that's a binary code, is a quaternary code, right? And we string this together 3 billion long, and we get lots of information. And genes, of course, are those sections of the genetic information that code for something functionally important in our life, right? Hemoglobin, the protein in our blood that carries oxygen from our lungs to the rest of our body, picks up carbon dioxide from our muscles, brings it back to the lungs, and we exhale carbon dioxide, right? Insulin, everybody had dinner this evening, I hope, right? You're digesting that dinner, you're now turning it into glucose. Glucose is taken by insulin and put into your cells by the hormone insulin. These are proteins encoded for by genes, the insulin gene, the hemoglobin gene. Right? And there are lots of genes that we have. Right? In fact, of the 3 billion bits of information, we found about 30,000 genes. So if I told you the 747 was made up of 30,000 parts, that's the equivalent, right? And most biologists were kind of disappointed that we only have 30,000 parts, right? It seems to us like we're very complex organisms, but it's the combinations of these parts that are important to make us so complex. In addition, while there are 30,000 genes, bits of information, strings of information in our chromosomes, they actually make multiple proteins. So we think that there are about 200,000 proteins that are made by those 30,000 genes. So probably the parts manual is going to be about 200,000 parts made from blueprints of 30,000 components. Right? And that's what they would be. And now we can ask a question that's a sort of, is the glass half full or is the glass half empty question. How many of these genes do we really know the function of, right? And how many do have no function? And that's what this little thing is about. And about half of the genes have known function and half not. So some biologists celebrated that our work right up to the year 2000 has given us the function of half of our components in the manual, parts manual. But other biologists looked at that glass as half empty and said, my goodness, we don't know half of the genes and what they do. Right? But that's about where we are right now. So let me now tell you about something that is interested us for the last 5 years now, since we got the sequence of the human genome. And that is something not called mutations, but something called polymorphisms. Poly, many, morphisms, structures, right? Many structures, right? And what polymorphisms are is differences between you and I. They're not mutations, the differences between you and I. They're just what makes us different. Right. Now, what's quite remarkable about ourselves, as you'll see in a minute, is that we're about, any two of us, you and I, for example, any two of us, you and I also, but not you and I, because I have a Y chromosome and you don't, so I won't count that. But any two males are 99.9% identical in their sequences of information, right? And they are therefore 0.1% non-identical, right? Now, that's pretty interesting. That means we are very closely related, 99.9% related in this audience. And that comes about because we're a very young species. We now know that humans arise in Africa about 150,000 years ago. 150,000 years is only 5,000 generations ago. So Adam and Eve come from Africa. It's actually about 10,000 individuals come from Africa, Central Africa, only about 150,000 years ago, only 5,000 generations away from everyone in this room. So we didn't have a lot of time to build diversity, right? So we're 99.9% identical. And this tells us how we build diversity. Here's a sequence of information, A, C, T, C, G, C, A, G, T, T. And that's going to be a sequence that almost everybody here has. However, seven of us here have the sequence A, C, T, that's the same, C, A, G, that's the same. And if this T is substituted with something else, let's say a G, 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 T. That's a T change that the majority of the population has to a G change, which only the seven of us in this corner have, right? That's a polymorphism. All of us are young, good-looking, terrific people, right? We have the same traits and characteristics, but we do have differences, and those differences are in polymorphisms. And as I told you, there's only 0.1% polymorphisms in the population, right? But 0.1% is 3 million differences between every two individuals, a lot of them, 3 million differences. And that's a polymorphism, right? A single base change called the single nucleotide polymorphism, often called the SNP. And that's what human variation is all about. Human variation is all about these polymorphisms. It's what makes you different than I in every genetic way, including how we digest our pills, right? Some of us do well on some pills and others do not. How we respond to various diseases, whether we get diseases or not. What are our genetic predispositions are all tied up in our polymorphisms. And so in the year 2000, the field of cancer research turns its attention to the differences between us to ask the question, could it help explain what's different about us in that some of us are predisposed to get cancer at a young age while others may not be? Is it more than oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes? Do polymorphisms play a role? This is fun. There's a whole new field that came up called comparative genomics. This is comparing the sequences of our genetic information, and you'll be humbled to know that you're about 99%, 95% similar to a mouse, right? I bet none of you really thought that before tonight, right? 95% similar to a mouse, 99% similar to a chimpanzee, and only 0.1% different from each other, right? So that's because we have a biological clock, if you will. We're about 100 million years separated from a common ancestor in mice. The mice and we had a common ancestor in evolution, right? Actually about 50 million years ago, and the two branches separate, so we're about 100 million years separate. We're only 7 million years separated from a chimpanzee. So 3.5 million years ago, we had a common ancestor, and we separated. And we're only 150,000 years ago separated from each other in Africa, right? And this began a whole field of comparative genomics, which I'm not going to go into in any detail, but I want to tell you a little bit, I promised, that I would end up by telling you a little bit about how our genetic predispositions play out in a disease like cancer, how polymorphisms are going to play a role in medical doctors' understanding of treatment and diagnosis and screening for cancer in the future. This is the, I've now brought you up to the year 2004, 2005, in the laboratory. Right? And I have to introduce you to a second player. Remember, I told you there's stress, right? The stress was sunlight, or the food you eat with chemical carcinogens, or the air you breathe with chemical carcinogens. Not here in Santa Barbara, the air is really good, right? But in other places, right? The air you breathe, right? Or if you smoke, right? This, that's stress. And what stress does is it activates the P53 protein, and the activation kills the cell, programs cell death, right? Well, for every positive thing, there has to be a negative regulator, right? I mean, what would happen if you got some stress and you started killing all your cells and you couldn't stop it? That would really be bad. So it's important to have a break on this, a stop. And the name of the break is the MDM2 break. And what it does is inhibits, that's what this sign is, P53. And P53 makes MDM2, right? So this is actually a neat circuit in your body where you have your own break, right? Every time you get too much sun, P53 rises and starts killing your cells. It makes MDM2, MDM2 then kills P53, and you stop killing yourself, right? And that's good, right? In fact, MDM2 is actually an oncogene. If you make too much of it, it puts the brakes on P53 and you never get started, right? You don't respond to stress. So it can be bad to have too much MDM2, right? And I'm going to tell you the story about some of us, about 11% of us, right? So I was told this room holds about 120 people. So about 12 of us in this room carry a polymorphism where we make too much MDM2, right? Now, that's not terrible or bad or anything else. Don't be worried yet, right? But I'm going to show you how we found that polymorphism in the human genome. We suspected that one would be important, right? So now I'm going to really get you into science by showing you the raw data, right? Here's the MDM2 gene, and here's that sequence. Now you can see why we need computers and computer scientists and physicists, right? There are 3 billion of these A's, T's, G's, and C's. I'm just showing you about 100 of them, right? And you can be bewildered and perplexed. But we did the sequencing of about 1,600 individuals, right? We sequenced the information in 1,600 individuals, and everybody had the same information along this route, right? Starting here in the gene, along this route. And then suddenly we saw that most people had T here, but about 11% of people had G, right? And that same thing here, most people had T, and about 1% of people had A, right? I'm going to focus on this change, right? So in this audience, most of us have T's at that position. We call the position 309. That's just the count. We're very unimaginative when we name these things. 309 is the count, right? The 309 spots from here to 309, right? So we call it SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism, 309, right? And so this is in the MDM2 gene. This is in the negative regulator of P53, the thing that turns off P53. And we hypothesized that this T to G change resulted in making too much MDM2. That means too much negative regulator. So the 11% of us that have GG, why GG? Because we have two copies, remember, right? So you could be GG, you could be GT, or you could be TT, right? Because we have two copies. But the 11% of us that have GG, in fact, make a lot of MDM2. A lot. Four times the amount. Right? And we could test that. We can just take blood cells from each of you and ask, how much MDM2 do you make? And about 11% of us make fourfold more. And they have GG. And the others that have TT make about one-fourth the amount of the GG group. Right? And so we asked, what effect does this have upon incidence of cancer? Right? And the first cancer we looked at is the one I told you about. Right? So we went to a cancer center in Houston called MD Anderson Cancer Center. It's one of the biggest. Families that have genetic predispositions to cancer, like the family I showed you on the first or second slide, This is a family that has three generations of cancer. They had P53 mutations. If they had P53 mutations in one of the two genes, that means they already have half the level of P53. So what would happen if you had half the level of P53, but four times the level of MDM2, right? It would be really bad. We would we looked at these families because we thought it would be the most catastrophic scenario, right? So I'm going to show you those families. These are actually the cancers that these families get. There were 88, now I'm turning to people, right? No longer talking about mice or monkeys or dogs. We're now, from here on in, we're doing the human genome and people. There are 88 people who have half the level of P53. Actually, the disease is called the Lee-Fraumini syndrome. And our co-workers at MD Anderson were Louise Strong and Gigi Lozano. And so this is raw data, right? These are the cancers these people get. In fact, of the 88 people in this cohort, all of whom carried this mutation, 66 already had had cancer. I'll show you their ages in a minute. And the average age at which they're getting cancer is 22 years, right? And the reason is they have one less mutation that's needed, right? Remember I told you you have to have five mutations to get cancer? They need four. It takes the age curve way down. Right? And so we understand why they're getting cancer at a young age. And here's the cancers they're getting. I'm going to show you the first two, soft tissue sarcomas. That's like Peyton Rouse. We go back to Peyton Rouse, except now in humans, sarcomas and breast cancers I'm going to show you. Right? So here are the individuals. Now we're back at the curve, looking at age of onset of human beings for cancer versus the number of individuals, because there's a small number here in this group, that are developing cancer. And these are cumulative curves. So this is the first cancer. First individual got cancer at the age of 2. The second at the age of 5. And the third at the age of 9, and so forth. And we draw a curve like that. And this is a pediatric cancer. You can see that already, that it's pediatric. It's gotten in 15 years. And those that had the TT that I told you about, this is the curve if you had TT and one P53 gene. This is the curve if you had GG and one P53 gene. If you just average that, the average age of onset of those that are wild type was 14 years. The average age of onset of those that had the GG was 2 years. 12 years younger because they had this difference that's a polymorphism. Now, don't worry if you're GG. Look what's happening here. This actually has terrific outliers. Why? Because it's not sufficient to get cancer if you have GG. It's just necessary. It's one of the components of getting cancer early. But there are people that have other genes, other polymorphisms that protect them against cancer. And that counterbalances. And here they are. Here are two of them, right here. But for most people, it's like that. And the exact same thing just as true for breast cancer. Now we've just moved the curve over in age. Average age goes from 39 to 29. And here's the curve if you're TT, and here's the curve if you're GG. Right? So this then discovers for the first time, this is not a mutation, it's a polymorphism. Actually, 11% of the population has this polymorphism. What's the value of this? Well, one of the values of this is that 11% should be screened at earlier ages because they're predisposed to get cancer at earlier ages. There's a response to the experiment, the genetic experiment. Right? So the next thing we did actually was go to... what I learned in working with human beings is it's great to work in countries that have socialized medicine. And the reason is that there's a common data set, there's a common group, they're all treated the same. Everything about it in America is a bit chaotic on our medical facilities. Everyone's treating things differently. The comparisons are tough. So we went actually to Germany. We went to a medical school in Halle, Germany, and we looked at individuals that had sarcomas. Right? We had 105 men and women that got sarcomas. And they didn't have any known genetic defects. This group has the genetic defect I showed you. This is a group that had no known genetic defects. And again, this is the age, and this is the percentage up to 105, right? The number up to 105 people, and these are the TTs, and these are the GGs, right? Look at that change. dramatic change. And again, for the mathematicians among us in the audience, this isn't heavy math, but if you take the average age of onset, there's about 12 years difference between GGs and TTs. If you take the median difference, there's much larger difference, and that's because of these outliers, right? There are always outliers that make the median difference larger than the average, right? And that's a tip-off. There are other polymorphisms in our genetic background that have an impact and stretch out the differences between us, right? Okay? So we're beginning, for the first time, to look within our own genes, not at mutations, just the differences between us, and predict individuals who might want to get colonoscopies more often, mammograms more often, PSA tests more often, who get cancer at a younger age and who could be watched. It's not possible to screen the whole population with mammograms, though, all of the women, under the age of 45, because that's why the ages start right so late, because it wouldn't be economically possible even to screen everybody from a very young age. It's also not practical for mammograms. But having said that, if we can fractionate the population genetically, we can have our doctors tell us you're predisposed to, and you'd be better off to get exams more often. Early detection is what helps us now. We're going to build bigger and better pills in the future, and we're going to learn how to prevent cancer, but early detection is what helps us now. Now, the other thing I want to finish up, I'm going to just take you over an extra minute or two, because I do want to finish up with an interesting story, right? This has actually given us some insight into therapies. There are some kinds of lymphomas that when this polymorphism, this GG change is present, the only people getting the cancer, the only people, are women under the age of 51 who are GG. In fact, I'll show you that. I'm going to skip a few things and show you that. This is an example. This is just the graph, percentage of people, right? And these are the people who have TT in blue. People who are TG, and this is about 650 individuals that have been looked at in this group. TG in red, and GG. Now, first of all, we have a change now. There are some ethnic groups, which I presume most of you are in, which actually have 11% GGs. There are other ethnic groups that have 25% GGs. Of course there would be. If you come from an ethnic group that's not a free breeding population, but has inbred in an ethnic group, you could have actually a different percentage of GGs in the population. This ethnic group, the controls, these are Ashkenazi Jewish controls, Jewish people that come from Eastern Europe originally, they have 25% GGs, about 27% TTs, and about 50% TGs. Right? Now, for women in this group, under the age of 51, there are no TTs, none. And look at the increase in the number of GGs that one has, right? Goes from less than 30% up to 50%. Right? And this all has to do with the complexity of the disease. This TT to GG change creates an estrogen-sensitive site. Under the age of 51, women are premenopausal, they have high estrogen. Over the age of 51, that's taken as the median cutoff for the start of menopause coming in. Over the age of 51, look how this goes back down. Right? Same disease, it's just that the genotype changes. Right? Now, this was a remarkable observation for us, because it said that estrogen is playing a role in a particular cancer that's not breast cancer. It's actually a lymphoma. It's called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, right? So actually the most common lymphoma, white blood cell disease. And this predicted for us, we haven't done the trial yet, we're just getting approvals to do the trial, predicted that an anti-estrogen should be used to treat this disease, but only in women under the age of 51 who are GG, right? Stratifying the population into treatments for the first time genetically, right? It's a really interesting concept of knowing your genes and how you will respond to a particular therapy. Antiestrogens are on the market for breast cancer all the time. It's not a matter of getting a new drug approved. It's a matter of understanding a disease and knowing how to apply the drug. Right? Now, I want to finish up with something that just happened, really bringing you up to date, because it was, I can give you the exact date when we got the first phone call from, now we go historically to Southern California. We went from Northern California. We're going to go to Scripps Research Institute, where there's a very large database of people, right, which is the Kaiser Permanente database. That's your insurance company in California here. Kaiser Permanente database for people who are in the southern part of California, right, from about Los Angeles down, I think, to San Diego. This is the group that we started working with. Now, these people are not people who have cancer or any other disease. In fact, what they only have in common is they signed up with the same insurance company, right? This is a group that I would call a normal set of controls, right, who happen to use the same insurance company. But of course, that insurance company is quite enlightened. They actually ask people who want to sign a document that says, I'll give a little bit of DNA and allow your records about your history of diseases over your lifetime, right, to be used in these kinds of studies. And we joined the group and went to the Kaiser Permanente database and asked a very different question that I'm going to end on. It's actually the reason why I'm here this week. We asked the question about aging and lifespan. Remember I told you lifespan's important. Percentage of lifespan is an important variable for this disease. So let me take you through the logic of what brought us to this question, and then I'll show you the result. Right? In fact, the question was a setup because we had already done experiments in mice. If we take a mouse and we give that mouse too much P53, right? So all of us have about the same, almost the same. I mean, remember the 11% of people who have too much MDM2, well, they have less P53. But all of us have, on the average, about the same P53 as do mice do. And so we give the mouse too much P53, right? That mouse is too good at responding to stress. Right? You could think of this as even psychological stress. It's too good. Right? And in fact, you could take that mouse and you could paint the mouse with carcinogens, just as they did in Tokyo in 1917. You paint that mouse with carcinogens, and it doesn't get cancer. Why? It is so good at killing the cells that have mutations in it that it can't get cancer. Right? So you'd think the pill that gives you more P53 would be terrific, right? Except that mouse dies at 9 months, right? Mice live 2 years, I told you. That mouse dies at 9 months. It dies an old mouse, as an old mouse. It's gray, it has wrinkled skin, right? Every time it responds to stress, it over-responds. It is so good at responding to stress that it gets old fast, right? Now, these individuals have high P53. These individuals have low P53, right? So these are the individuals I've been telling you get cancer at an earlier age, and these are the individuals that respond a little too well to stress. So we made the hypothesis, could it be that these individuals in the middle, those that have T and G, just the right amount of positive and just the right amount of negative, this is just what my mother told me, always live your life in moderation, right? Just the right amount, right? If you have the right amount, will you live longer, right? And that's where we use the Kaiser Permanente database. Because in that database, we had people who were young and people who were old, and they died of various diseases, and we could even track down what diseases they died of. And this is the same distribution for aging, right? So now with this, we're talking about 1,400 individuals being typed, right? And this is the individuals in the sign for this insurance company who have below the age of 75. We're back to the 11% group, about 12% here in GG, in TT here. This is actually just for Caucasians, because again, African Americans and Ashkenazi Jews have different levels, right? So this is just Caucasians in California. So here we have the heterozygotes, the TGs, and here we have the TTs under the age. Look what happened above the age. Right? This stayed about the same. This came down, and this goes up. Right? And this is pretty significant, right? The p-value means how could this have happened at random, right? So it's 3 times 10 to the minus third chance that this happened by random. There's less than than 1 in 100 chance it could happen but randomly, right? And in fact, you could do a whole bunch of statistics on this, and it is very improbable this would have happened at random, right? And what we see is a terrific increase in the heterozygotes and a decrease in the over responders to stress, right? So here's the first hint that in our genes is not, this is, genes are not deterministic. I have to finish this way, right? This doesn't mean if you're a TG you're going to live longer, right? There are, after all, automobile accidents and virus infections and a whole bunch of other things, right? But it does mean that genes are probabilistic, and that's where this comes up. That given a good life, a lucky life, right? If you know how to respond to stress, just the right amount, it can protect you and enriched opportunities when you're later on in life, and that's the kind of thing we see here. So we're beginning for the first time, let me sum up, I've taken you from 1911 all the way to 2005, and we've moved into the genetic information that's us. And it's not deterministic, it's probabilistic, but it begins to tell us something about how medicine will be practiced in the future. And it will surely include the polymorphisms that are found in our genes. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Arnie, for a fascinating talk. And as usual, we open the floor for questions, which I'm sure Arnie is delighted to take.
Yep.
I just ask you to wait till you get the microphone so everybody else can hear your question. And we're open for questions.
I tried. I picked on you all the time. And
you're a very wonderful talk.
Thank you.
Suggests that if a young medical student came to you and asked what should he study, you would say, do not look for the magic bullet. The next great discovery will not be like penicillin. It will be of a different type. And then you could give your lecture to give some ideas. But when it comes to someone who's over the age of 75,
congratulations.
How does he apply the very same conclusions and generalizations?
I'm really tempted to give you this facile answer, like my mother would say, just take plenty of chicken soup and lead a moderate life. And right, I'm not allowed to give medical advice up here. I want to actually turn your question into something that I usually like to finish with, because I think it's important. What do you do when you've lived a reasonable percentage of your life here? One of the things that we've learned about cancer is what are the causes. I've taken you through the causes, but I haven't taken you through the consequences of that. Right? I mean, ideally, now that we understand the causes of cancer, it's in our genes, we understand that there's a defective gene somewhere that's causing the cancer. Could we use that information to attack it rather than using these really horrible treatments that we presently have for cancer, which are very debilitating and make people fear the disease, right? And I'll tell you the story of one big success. It's unfortunate we don't have more, but it's a wonderful success. There happens to be a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia. It's a disease of the white blood cells, like the one I showed you, but it's actually even rarer. It's 5,000 cases a year. It's a chronic disease. And we know the cause. The cause is that two chromosomes come together and one of these oncogenes suffers a mutation. And we actually know the function of that oncogene. And a drug company named Novartis made an inhibitor of that oncogene product, of the function of that oncogene, right? And it stopped the cancer. It has no side effects. People take the pills every day. They take it chronically for the rest of their life. And they no longer have chronic myelogenous leukemia, right? Because we understand the disease, you can make a specific inhibitor, right? Now, that's a disease that we're lucky with. I mean, there are other diseases that are running rampant. And let me say that it's a little bit like infectious disease. When penicillin came on, it was a magic bullet, as you've said. There's a magic bullet, penicillin, and the bacteria became resistant. Well, that happens in 1 or 2% of the cases of chronic myelogenous leukemia. When you take it for life, you get resistance. 1% a year of people get resistance. So you fail the treatment. But we understand why they fail. And we make another antibiotic, right? And we kill it again, right? And so we're really beginning to have a rational basis of designing therapies. Now, the kind of sad thing right now in today's world is we're knocking off one cancer at a time this way, and we're not able yet to tackle the ones that are big: lung, colon, breast, and prostate. 80%, 75% of all cancers. But the little ones right now are attackable because we understand that. And I think that what will help everybody is the development of these drugs that are coming along, which are not poisons, but come from the rational basis of understanding the disease. And that's really what the pharmaceutical industry and the biotech industry are about today, is to forget about these poisons and start making rational drugs and rational choices. And that's the good news about the future. When it comes, I can't predict. How successful it'll be on the big cancers, I can't predict. But we're trying. Understanding the disease is the first step. Being able to conquer it is the future goal. I think this gentleman... Oh, he's got the microphone. I'm going to try for you, though. Yeah.
There are markers for various kinds of cancer. They're typically blood things. They're clearly not genetic analysis.
Right.
What are they? Sorts of things?
Yeah, so markers for cancers like PSA, right, are just proteins that are overproduced by some subset of prostate cancers. The problems with those markers are that sometimes cells which are not prostate cancer overproduce PSA, so you get a false positive diagnosis. Sometimes prostate cancer doesn't produce PSA, so you get a false negative, right? But most of the time, the sort of distribution is such that it still pays to do a PSA test and then follow it up, right? But that isn't the cause of the disease, right? It's just an epiphenomenon marker. And in fact, if you attack it, people have tried to take prostate cancer and turn off PSA, right? It does nothing to the cancer except turn off the one marker you have to follow the progression of the cancer. So the markers are useful diagnostic tools, but they're not useful for cure. It's the oncogenes that cause the disease. If we knew how to attack the oncogenes or the tumor suppressor genes, we'd be on. Yeah. What's that?
You have described the four different types of causes of cancer, but what about during these days where people are using cell phones and EMF radiation more often? Would you say cell phone use would be a reasonable cause of cancer as we go into the
recovery? No. I don't. Usually you like to... before you scare everybody, you usually like to have some evidence for things. And there's just no rational basis at this time, nor evidence to say that. There's a lot of anecdotal stuff, right? But anecdotal stuff leads you often into weird directions. So the answer is, here's a problem. You presented a very interesting problem I'd like to just talk about for a second, if I could. I actually, this was a long time ago, 1996, I chaired a committee, it was an unwieldy committee of 111 people, to redo the $1.4 billion budget in the National Institutes of Health for AIDS research, right? The reason to redo the budget in 1996 was the budget, like any government budget. It was chaotic at the time. The epidemic starts in 81, is recognized in 81. Everyone's pouring money into it, but no one's looking at the whole overall picture. And we wanted, and the government asked me to chair the committee, because I didn't work on AIDS, to redo that budget, right? And we took a lot of public testimony, and an awful lot of people, much like yourself, said, look, the AIDS community is using this drug that comes from Mexico to treat themselves, and you've got to do a clinical trial on that drug, right, to say whether it's safe or not for the community. Why? Because the community is using it, right? And that's the most slippery slope for science that there is. Why? Because we could spend $1.4 billion on clinical trials for any drug that someone decided was being imported from Mexico to use, right? Or for, in fact, listening how much we use our telephones and so forth. You could actually spend a tremendous amount of money, and then there'd be no cure for, there's no cure now, but there'd be no treatment for AIDS, because you wouldn't take your best bets, right? You wouldn't really, you really have to have a group of scientists sit down and say, there's a rational basis to do this experiment, let's do it, right? And there is at this point not a lot of rationale, except this is anecdotal, to suggest that using cell phones is causing ear cancer or is causing brain cancer. There just isn't any real reason to do the experiment. But if there are a group of people who believe it, they ought to raise the funds privately and actually do the study. That would be a reasonable response. But I don't think the government ought to do the study until we really know that there's a reason that we want to do the study. Oh, we have this gentleman who I picked on. I promised I would.
Thank you. The genetic profiling, it seems like you made an excellent case for that being very useful. Is it being used at all, and what do you see as the progression of that?
That's a really good question. There are two things that slow down advances. Maybe they're good things, or maybe they're bad things, but they slow down advances from the laboratory into practice of medicine. The first thing that slows it down is third-party payers. They're very reluctant to keep adding these things to their armamentarium of costs, right? And so they will be slow to adopt it. So if you want a genetic test, and if you go to your doctor and ask for a genetic test, most of the time they say, I can get it for you, but you have to pay for it. The insurance company won't pay, right? And so that can be good and that can be bad. I mean, a conservative medical institution isn't all bad, and that's the payment of medical care. But probably more complex is the doctors themselves. We talked about medical school, right? In medical school today, they have a human genetics course, right? Why? Because of experiments like this. Doctors are coming out of medical school really prepared to know what single, now everybody knows here, you could probably get your medical degrees, right? Single nucleotide polymorphisms are, right? But if you're a 50-year-old practitioner, you've never had a human genetics course in medical school. And you could take one on the web or read a book or things, but implementing it in the doctor's office even takes the continuing education and complexities. In fact, remember I kept saying, this is not deterministic. This is probabilistic, right? That's very difficult for doctors. It's very difficult for patients. What would you do if you went to your doctor's office and the doctor said you had 35% chance of getting so-and-so, right? You'd say, well, I don't want to know that. I want to know, do I have it? Do I not have it? Am I going to get it? What should I do? Right? You wouldn't want a probabilistic answer. And yet, genetics is very probabilistic in many ways. It depends on your environment. It's not separate from your environment. And all our environments are different, right? So doctors are going to have to spend a little more time getting educated, but then a little more time with their patients explaining to the patients what this information means. Right? So like everything else, unfortunately, this makes it more complex for third-party payers and more complex for the doctors, and it's that which will slow down the implementation. When it becomes overwhelming, I think this will become overwhelming. The one example I gave rather quickly, the ability to, first of all, women who are GG, who are taking estrogen, are at enormous risk to have this disease that has estrogen driving it, right? So here's the problem, and we heard recently, in fact, it almost ruined American Home Products, a pharmaceutical company, why they sell the 1.6 billion in estrogen, right? And then we heard, oh, estrogen can cause heart attacks and it can raise the frequency of breast cancer slightly, right? Everyone's confused about all this. It's very the marginal kind of data. But we hope someday we'll be able to fractionate the population of women that say, oh no, you're okay to take estrogen. It had no effect on breast cancer or heart disease, but you should not take estrogen. And the reason is your genetic endowment is such that, right? That would be a big advantage for the to move ahead. And the pharmaceutical companies, which have the bucks, begin to realize this. And they're going to start to play ball. That'll be the first thing. Yeah. I think there's a gentleman in the balcony here.
Interesting. I'm in the insurance business, both health insurance as well as life insurance. And the probabilistic avenue down there is interesting. You could be tested, and if it's not probable, if it's probable, the insurance company probably won't take you. If it's not probable, why spend your money on insurance?
Right. Exactly. You bring up a big and interesting question. When I was a professor at Princeton University, I used to have an economist come in to lecture to my students who took molecular biology just about questions that you brought up. Everything about insurance is it's a fair bet. You don't know whether I'm going to get a disease, and I don't, you know, and so you'll insure me, and if I don't get the disease, you win and I win, and if I do get the disease, you lose and I lose, right? So it's a bet, though, right? What happens if the information is not shared? I know my genetic endowment, but I don't share it with my insurance company. Right? That changes the bet, doesn't it? That's an interesting problem. Well, what happens if the insurance company knows the information, right? Then all bets are off. You probably won't get insurance, or you'll have to pay a higher rate, right? So it's quite interesting. As of today, in today's world, you and your doctor know your genetic endowment, but your insurance company is kept in the dark, right? And that may be just the reason why insurance companies are going to raise rates, because they're kept in the dark and the bet is a little bit less clear, right? I know to take insurance, but he knows he doesn't have to, right? And so suddenly you've got a high-risk pool, right? And you don't have anything to do with it because I have the information, he has the information, and you don't. So it's very interesting how this changes society, how this changes economies, how this changes lots of things, and we have to sort this out. I have to say, one of the problems I find with the government is they don't like to talk about genes, right? They don't like to talk about genetic endowments and privacy and what it's going to mean. And so we just sail through in science doing these experiments without the social consequences or the economic consequences coming out. That's one of the good things about lectures like this. That's one of the goals of universities, at least, to educate.
Okay, two more.
You've identified the gene and exactly where it is in the chain. I saw lectures like 10 years ago at Caltech where they were splicing those genes in plants. I mean, why can't you go in and fix it?
Yeah, that's a great thing. So actually, about 10 years ago, it became clear that the P53 gene that I told you about was mutated in cancer, right? So what would happen if we could put it back? Would it kill the cancer? Because I told you it kills cells that, right? So a pharmaceutical company called Aventis in France created a virus, put the gene in the virus. We had to clone that gene actually 1983, 84, right? We didn't patent it or anything, but they just took it and they cloned it and they put it in the virus. And then they inoculated it into a tumor you could inject into head and neck tumors. And in many and then they irradiated the tumor, actually, because it's just like sunlight. They gave it a radiation. And then in many cases, the tumors melted away, right? And they began clinical trials. They've done phase one. That means it's safe. They've done phase two, and they're on hold now. The FDA is very nervous about this treatment. It's a gene therapy treatment. It's a complicated treatment. It uses a virus, right? So the FDA is slowing them down. They're a little worried. It's a lot of money to do the phase three trial. In the meantime, this has all been approved in China. And there are 10,000 patients in China being treated by this virus, right? There's a small biotech company, not small probably anymore, it's making a lot of money, in China, in Beijing. that I'm very proud of, because they've taken the gene we cloned and they're putting it back into people. It's not inherited, it's just injected into the tumor, irradiating the tumor, and they're getting pretty good results. So we're busy watching the results that they get in China. It's a very interesting example. Different countries have different risk strategies, right? And our country is moving to the most conservative risk strategy. We are petrified of Vioxx, right? We are and this will drive the FDA to not approve drugs, because there's a risk to a small number of people who take the drug, right? We want risk-free environment. None of us should get in an automobile accident driving home, a risk-free environment, right? It's not likely that that's ever going to be the case, no matter what the drug is. There's always a risk-reward ratio of drugs. There's always some people with a genetic endowment that's going to change. So it's interesting that a country like China is willing to take the risk. And so I would predict that there's going to be some wealthy Americans who hear about this, who happen to have head and neck cancer, who are going to fly to Beijing to get treatment because they can't get it in the United States, or fly to Europe to get treatment because they can't get it in the United States. So there are going to be very interesting consequences as we get more and more global, right? But it's a shame that only the wealthy could get this kind of treatment if it's a good treatment. I don't even know that yet, but if it is a good treatment. You mean that there are other diseases?
Other cancers, other tumors.
Sure. There may be about 200 oncogenes and about 25 tumor suppressor genes, and they all do some different things.
But I mean that have been studied in the way you study P53,
MND2. I have to say that this is a sort of interesting reason. This is why I think it happened. When the genome was sequenced in the year 2000, I turned 60. And I had a wonderful career in science, and I said, it's time for me to stop working with mice, right? It's about time that I try to take my lab and see if we could work with human beings. And if all we learned, I celebrated with you tonight, all we've learned about cancer, if all we've learned about cancer in the year 2000 can't be applied to human beings, what does it mean, right? How do you apply it to human beings? I mean, after all, I'm a research lab, not even a medical doctor. So we decided to apply it to human beings by looking at genetic endowment, right? And there have been episodically in the literature a gene that predisposes to this or to that. But actually, we just published the paper actually in November of 2004, was the first paper. It took 4 years to carry out that research from the year 2000. It's an extremely talented group of postdocs that was led by, I really should give them credit, by Gareth Bond and Wenwei Hu. And those two doggedly traced this down. Graduate students and postdocs gave their DNA, right? When I said 50 individuals were sequenced, they were graduate students and postdocs on our floor, right? The volunteers were, there's something called an internal review board that IRB that prevented me from speaking to the graduate students and postdocs about this. Why? Because you're not allowed to put pressure on them to participate. And I was the professor, right? So we had to have surrogates go and ask them if they would participate and so forth. We ran into a big problem that we never anticipated. It's just like wonderful science, right? Graduate students and postdocs graduate and they leave, right? So we suddenly lost our 50 individuals, right, over a period of 4 or 5 years who had contributed their DNA. And if we wanted to get more, we had to go chasing around the world to find those individuals. So we actually found a better way to do that. But that was a wonderful four-year adventure, and it's pretty new. That paper's just published. The data I showed you is just published. And there probably are two biotech companies and three or four labs that do things like this. It's the beginning. I only tell you about what's new, right, in the year 2005. It's just the beginning. But I think, once the density of people studying this comes up, everybody's favorite gene, I studied my favorite gene, right, everybody's favorite gene will be studied and we'll know a lot more.
Okay, I think we're... I think we'll stop there. I wanted to say something about the questions. I always say that the questions at KITP public lectures are outstanding. I'm always amazed at our audience, and so I thank you all and congratulate you all. You all passed. You get A plus.
That's right.
And
get your degree on the way out.
Before we break, I hope you'll all join us for refreshments in the common room. Maybe get a chance to talk to Arnie some more. And those of you who are don't know or not members of the Friends of the KITP, there's information about it on the table right here. You can sign up or at least find out about it. And let's thank. Well, you just thank Arnie once again, but he deserves another round.
I've got almost as many rounds of applause as Bush did tonight, right?
I hope so.
Terrific.
Thank you. We're going to have a